and I am the executive director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. We're 5 minutes after. I think this will be sort of a slow rolling start. I suspect we may have a couple more people join us. I hope that you all found the packets that we have over there on the side table. We'll be referring to those as we go through. This initial meeting of the subcommittee of the Campaign Finance Board is looking to gather information from you, and certainly from anyone who is here to testify, but anyone who wishes to submit comments on two sets of administrative rules that the board is considering. One, the board believes is non-controversial, and by that I mean its amendments and updates to existing administrative rules, bring those rules into compliance and to agreement with statutory changes that have been enacted since the rules were adopted. Those have been outlined in a packet to you. The language there has obviously been put in place. We would like you to review those, and then as we go through this process, we're not going to be asking the subcommittee to move on that at this particular meeting, but at the next meeting, we are going to be looking to see if there's any feedback on what we believe is non-controversial. And if there isn't, then we're going to be looking to fast track that set of rules and perhaps be bringing those to the full board relatively soon. The second set, which is a set of topics which does not have any language developed at this point, is dealing with more controversial areas, and those areas the board is still trying to develop feedback, trying to understand the issues before it, and then getting ready to move forward then in drafting language. There in particular, we need public input, and the board needs to hear from the public both at these series of meetings and in any written response that people may wish to submit, so that we understand what the regulated community, how they view these rules, how they view the topics that the board is considering, and so that the board then has that information as it moves forward. Just for an informational standpoint, this came up in one subcommittee, but it might help better explain where the board is at here. There are two, in Minnesota statutes, 10A02, there are two subdivisions that deal with administrative rules, and with your permission, I think I'll just read them both. Subdivision 13 rules, Chapter 14 applies to the board. The board may adopt rules to carry out the purposes of this chapter, and that's the general authority of the board, obviously, to look at any section of 10A that it believes needs clarification or needs to be expanded upon an administrative rule for administrative purposes. Above that, you also have Subdivision 12A, Advisory Opinions Rules. If the board intends to apply principles of law or policy announced in an advisory opinion issued under Subdivision 12, more broadly than to the individual or association to whom the opinion was issued, the board must adopt those principles or policies as rules under Chapter 14. When you look through the one handout that you have on the potential controversial rules and those subjects, usually have behind it, besides a brief description of the type of topic that the board is looking at, usually has an administrative rule or two or three reference to it. And that is an area that that staff at least believes the board is somewhat behind. There are some advisory opinions which we believe are being relied on by the broader community, and that are it's appropriate then to bring those administrative rules, or at least consider bringing those administrative rules, those advisory opinions into administrative rules, so that it's easier for the regulated community to find those references, to find that guidance, and so that, again, it's a consistent position for the board to have on those issues. With that, sort of as a general background as to why we're here, I'd like to introduce everyone that you have at this front table. To my right is Kyle Fisher, he's a legal analyst with the board, who will be helping us draft the language for the for the administrative rules. At the other end is Jody Pope. She is also a legal analyst. She also will be helping with the drafting. Ms. Pope has also done quite a few sets of administrative rules, both with this agency and with other agencies, and so she's going to be sort of our resident expert on the procedures that you go through when you adopt administrative rules. To my immediate left is Peggy Lepek. She is a member of the board, has been since I have this down here somewhere.
May of 2015.
She is a former member of the state rep, as a, of the state legislature. She served from 1991 to 2003. She is a former Republican state legislator. She also worked on the Metropolitan Council from 2003 through 2011. To her left is Robert Mullinan. He joined the board in October of 2016. Mr. Mullinan worked for 30 years with the Popham Haake Law Firm, although he also then came back to the state and concluded his professional career as Director of Securities for the state of Minnesota from 2011 to 2014. And they will then be basically providing guidance to staff as to what they hear, what information they hear from the public, help staff understand how we should be drafting rules to reflect those concerns in the direction of the board. And then eventually the work of this subcommittee will be taken back to the full board, who will then be looking at the issues of what the full board wants to move forward with as administrative rules. So this is sort of part one, where the subcommittee develops the language for those rules, and then in the end, the full board will be looking at that set of proposals that comes out of this subcommittee. I guess at that point, I would ask if there's any questions before we move on from there.
On our flowchart here, are we at the second arrow here for comments? Is that how this works?
Yeah, on the flowchart, I'd say we're in the request for comments stage. And then we'll be kind of moving to the end of that and developing some language as these meetings go forward and we hear more from the public about the issues that are out there. So, yeah, definitely in the purple request for comments stage.
Thank you.
Technically, I think the request for comments was published on December 5th in the State Register, but we can extend that period of time. I think the deadline for providing a written comment, at least in that statement, was February 3rd, but the board is certainly open to receiving comments past that deadline. That's just a minimum amount of time that people had to respond to that notification. We have had two individuals who have indicated that they would like to make a presentation. The first is dealing with independent expenditures. That's George Beck. Mr. Beck, if you're ready, if you'd come up.
My name is George Beck, and I've been recently talked into chairing a new nonprofit called Minnesota Citizens for Clean Elections. I'd like to thank you for the chance to talk about possible rules this afternoon. My remarks are directed only to a potential rule that would define what constitutes cooperation between a candidate and an independent committee. I think a rule is needed because candidates, parties, and independent committees need to know what the rules are. The statute is vague and does not spell out what is permitted and what is not. This is a classic use of agency rulemaking, defining vague statutory terms that have created problems for those who are regulated. And there have been problems. Parties have had to grapple with the meaning of cooperation in several cases, excuse me, at least two of which have resulted in larger fines. The board acknowledged in one of those cases that there simply was no precedent to follow. And I see there's a case that just came out, I think on the 31st of January, involving use of the same vendors and whether somebody was in dual roles with both the candidate and the independent committee. Without a clear definition, candidate contribution limits may be unintentionally circumvented and parties are then subject to board action. This rule should have bipartisan support. All who are subject to the statute will benefit from a clear rule, and Minnesota citizens and the board will benefit from a clear rule since it is in their interest to see that the statute and contribution limits are enforced. The Citizens United Court emphasized that an important safeguard for the increases in political spending that it sanctioned was that independent expenditures would be truly independent of the candidate. This has certainly not happened at the federal level, and I think that Minnesota can do much better in that regard. Several other states have seen the need for and have adopted cooperation rules that could provide guidance for the board in fashioning a rule for Minnesota. Additionally, the board staff has identified advisory opinions that would help spell out what's required in a proposed rule. I've submitted written materials on the main items that seem to be included in the rules in other states, and just briefly, they include a candidate not participating in fundraising for an independent committee. Oh, and I wanted to mention that this really ought to include undeclared candidates who later announce their candidacy. I think we saw in the federal election that at least one candidate collected an enormous amount of money involving an independent committee before he announced his candidacy. An independent expenditure may not be based upon information that the candidate or his or her committee provided to the independent committee. In most rules, they indicate that you may not use the same consultants or vendors. Rules often provide that an independent committee may not be established, run, or staffed by an individual related to the candidate or who previously held a position with the campaign. And finally, an independent committee usually is told they cannot reproduce any candidate communication distributed by the candidate or his or her committee. They also submitted some rules that would indicate specifically what is permitted, which is certainly a reasonable thing to do so people know how to avoid a violation of the statute. Additionally, one of the things that has caused a big problem federally are one candidate independent committees. And I think that it would be within the province of the board to find that they are within the definition of cooperation. At least one state has provided that prohibitions in its rules were only prima facie violations. I would urge the board not to follow that example and create clear and enforceable standards. I'd like to emphasize that this rule will in no way limit independent expenditures, but merely provide guidelines to avoid violating the statute. I'm eager to see what the board proposes, and we'll certainly continue to participate in the rulemaking process. Thank you.
Mr. Beck, would you stand for a few questions or sit for a few questions?
If I have to, yes.
I was wondering if you had any insight on your first area that you're concerned about, a candidate participating in a fundraising for an independent expenditure committee. Is there any time frame when you think that that would be an issue? For example, if they did it 4 years before a committee made an independent expenditure on behalf of that or against that candidate?
Well, what I don't think should apply is a 60-day rule similar to that before elections. Obviously, campaigns now are starting a couple of years before the election, and I think anything that happens in that time period ought to fall within this rule.
Related to that, have you thought how you would, within Chapter 10A, the term candidate is well defined, but I'm not sure what an undeclared candidate would be. How would you propose that the board look at that?
I don't have a definition for that, but obviously it's a candidate who later announces that he's running in a particular election, but is collecting money, collecting funds and contributions before he announces. I don't have an exact definition, but I'll bet there's one out there somewhere.
I have a question. Thank you. I'm wondering on the third one here, regarding the use of consultants and vendors. I can certainly see prohibiting consultants. I think it's very difficult for one consultant to not know what's going on if he's consulting for both parties. But vendors, I just wonder if they, particularly if it's a very large vendor, may be completely unaware of any political connection between the two, or may not have anything other than a strictly business connection, whether a broad prohibition like this might be really quite burdensome for either the candidate or the independent committee.
You know, some further refinement on that might be beneficial. I think I would look at what other states have done and the reasons that they've advanced for that particular item. I know it's very common, but you may well want to measure the burden on the regulated as against the benefit from that particular item.
I have another question. Independent expenditure may not be based upon information that the candidate or his or her committee provided to the independent committee, either directly or indirectly. I can envision a situation where somebody says, a candidate says something that goes down the line and very indirectly gets to that committee. So a direct communication is easy to understand. But how indirect do you think that this connection should have to be allowed?
You know, I would think that there's probably some decisions under these rules across the country that would further define that. Obviously, there's a rule for the role for the board here in making a judgment in cases like that. I think, as you suggest, sometimes it can get so indirect it doesn't have any meaning within the rule. So I can't, you know, tell you exactly how to define that, but I think it's something that is probably necessary if people doing using the rule find a way to circumvent the direct language.
I think what gets me is if the candidate knowingly provides information that will either directly or indirectly get to the committee, if it is completely unwittingly conveyed, I think that's rather different.
Well, I would agree, and it's difficult to prove knowledge. Some things are so clear that I think you can presume that there was knowledge involved. And again, I think it would be within the discretion of the board to decide if there's a violation that is unknowing, whether that deserves much of a penalty of any sort.
First of all, thank you for your past service to the board and for your service as an administrative law judge. And thank you for coming today with your comments. I have just a few questions. In your written comments, you cite primarily to Maine, California, and advisory opinions. It's obvious to me that you've done some searching. Are there any other states which it would be helpful for this board to look to on the issues you're raising?
Yes.
What other states would those be?
Oh, I came by those states simply by reading articles commenting on cooperation rules. And those were examples that were pointed to as good rules that have been adopted fairly recently. But I haven't made a full search to try and uncover all of them. I'm aware that the Florida statute has a cooperation rule that might be helpful. And there are model rules for a cooperation rule that I submitted with my comments. And I imagine that that might be a source of finding out what other states have done.
You know, I'm relatively new to the board, so help me out here a little bit more, given your history. Right now, if there is a violation of the independence of an expenditure, it is somewhat within the judgment and discretion of the board as to whether or not there was a violation of that independence. And what you're proposing really is a clarification that will reduce some of that discretion in the sense of providing treasurers and other people in campaigns with an idea of what the board considers to be, or what the state considers to be, if the rules were adopted, to be truly lacking independence, or correct? So it basically provides guidance, direction, and eliminates some discretion on the part of the board.
I think that's accurate. You folks really have too much to do anyway, and I think that's what people need. I mean, there's been a lot of cases presented to the board where folks just didn't understand what cooperation in the statute meant. And so this is going to be very helpful to people that want to abide by the statute. They don't want to get into trouble. They don't want to circumvent the contribution requirements in the statute. You wouldn't have quite as much discretion, but you'd have people that understand exactly what's required and hopefully have fewer cases.
Okay. Now, the board is not in a position where it can change its penalty provisions or enforcement mechanism. That's up to the legislature to do. That's not for us to do. So let's assume for a moment that your proposals were adopted, and that there was developed some sense of what would not be independent in the future. To the extent there would be a violation of that, a relative of a candidate runs a PAC, and the rule says, no, you can't do that anymore, you can't have that kind of close proximity. The independent expenditure becomes really a violation of the campaign contribution limits. So is it the candidate that ends up being in violation of it, or is it the independent expenditure political committee, or is it both? And do you have a sense of what the penalty would be for that type of violation?
I don't know what the penalty would be under the statute and rules exactly, but I think the rule has to be fashioned so that it applies both to candidates and independent committees. And I know in the DFL Senate caucus case, that was what was done. Both of those things were examined, and that's appropriate. But I noticed that some of the rules seem to think it just applies to the independent committee, and that's. It has to be fashioned in a way that includes a candidate.
Thank you.
Mr. Beck, I noticed that you began your statement by, and your written material indicates that your comments or suggestions are for independent expenditure committees. Do you think that any of these provisions then would apply to either regular political committees and funds that make independent expenditures, or the political party units that make independent expenditures?
Well, what I've submitted, I think applies to political parties like the DFL Senate Caucus, the Republican Caucus, the state committees, things that are traditionally thought of as independent expenditure committees. But how far that goes, I haven't really examined.
Okay. But for clarification, then, it's fair to say that you think that the rules or the areas that you think should be developed would apply to any committee registered with the board that makes independent expenditures? Is that fair?
Yes.
On your fourth suggestion, an independent committee may not be established, run, or staffed by an individual who is related to the candidate or previously held a position at the candidate's campaign or worked in an advisory capacity to the campaign committee. Would you also think that that would extend to the issue of a former staff member of an incumbent? That's the kind of the one area that you didn't include that you often see in those type of prohibitions. Would that be something that you would be for or against?
Well, I would include that within previously held a position with the candidate's campaign, but yes, I think a former staff member ought to be included within the rule.
Do you think there's a time frame that that, again, would fall under?
Well, I'd have the same answer to that. You know, it shouldn't be 60 days. It ought to be when the campaign is really occurring. And we've fallen into this situation where people are announcing far in advance and extending campaigns far longer than anybody wants to have them occur. But I think it does have to cover the period of the actual campaign.
In the area, the topic right above that, number three, the candidate, in the independent expenditure committee may not use the same consultants or vendors. There is a current advisory opinion dealing with vendors that the board has issued, which basically acknowledged the possibility of a firewall, that a vendor that had that prepared material both for candidates and, for example, political parties who may do an independent expenditure, that a firewall could be created that would allow one vendor to provide both services. Do you think that would be possible, or would you prefer not to see that?
I think that would make some sense. I think, as Member Lepick said, when you come to vendors, you know, we're a pretty large metropolitan area, but still, I think there's probably vendors who sort of specialize in political matters, and perhaps some language that would permit that to happen, you know, some kind of safe harbor would make sense.
And then on the back of your material on areas where it does not constitute cooperation between the independent committee and a candidate, number two, the independent committee obtains material about a candidate from a public available source. Does that, and I'm sorry, there's probably a more specific one in here, but when you say material, does that include pictures, videos, or are you just talking about positions of the candidate, or what does material refer to?
I think that refers to a wide variety of things, not just written information, but would also include things like videos and photos.
Okay.
And you know, it'd be interesting to know how the Maine folks interpret that, which I think you could find out.
Do you have any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Oney, did you want to come up? Before, and I'm sorry, before Ms. Doney sits down, was there anyone else that wanted to have a comment related to independent expenditures or any topic related to independent expenditures? Okay, I'm sorry. So, would you come on? I believe Ms. Doney wishes to present some comments and information on non-campaign disbursements related to
the well, actually, I just wanted to say good afternoon to the board members. As you know, okay, my name is Gordy Lane Jr. I am a Brooklyn Park resident volunteer, have been since 1998. And in 2014, it's the first time that I got involved at the state level. I am currently the campaign treasurer for the current mayor of Brooklyn Park, Jeff Lundy. I am currently the campaign treasurer for former Brooklyn Park City Council member Peter Crema Jr. Backing up, Jeff Lundy ran for state senate in the last election. Peter Crema ran for state house of representatives in the last election. And I'm just here to listen, learn, and give my input whenever possible, and if you have any questions. Seeing none, I'll sit down.
Okay, sir, thank you. Well, as I started, I suppose, trying to describe how this meeting was going to go, we certainly wanted to have the individuals who indicated that they wanted to make comments to the subcommittee have a chance to say those comments. We wanted to get in to the record those comments and also provide everyone in the audience with copies of both the material that the board is looking at and the comments that have been submitted in writing. Those are all available. There is, as I also mentioned, two sets of rules, I guess you'd say, which were provided and which we are looking for comment at our next meeting. One is the proposed technical amendments, which has, again, we believe that these are not particularly controversial. They're just updating existing rules. The explanation as to why the update is necessary is on the margins. We'll be looking for any feedback, and again, if you can't make the next meeting, certainly feel free to contact Jody Pope. Her email address is on the agenda to provide any information that you have that where you would feel that we're mistaken, that there's one provision here that in fact is controversial, or maybe two provisions. If that's the case, what we may very well do is look at moving that into the different track, move it into the other set of rules that are more controversial, that will take more time to develop, and where we need to be more concerned about the possible impact. There is another sheet which you have, which is entitled Potential Technical Amendments, which we admit are sort of in the middle ground, and I'd like to go over those two just briefly to see what we're talking about. The first, 4503.0500 on contributions, is an existing rule, but it was written prior to things like PayPal and receiving contributions over the internet were common. And so now we have kind of the question of how does that apply when contributions are submitted electronically and the committee may not have immediate access to those contributions. It comes into play in two ways. One, there's a statutory requirement in 10A that contributions need to be deposited within 10 days of being received by a committee. The problem with that is that there's often a delay between when the contribution is made by the donor and when PayPal or an equivalent entity like PayPal is willing to release those contributions to a particular bank account. Sometimes it's up to 5 days, we found. So now, at what point then does that 10 days start? Does it start when the contributor hits send, or is it really within 10 days of when you as the committee treasurer have access to those funds and you can actually move them down into your account? The second issue related to that is that we have very specific deadlines as to when contributions can be raised that count against the affidavit of contributions. The affidavit of contributions is the document submitted by candidates who signed the public subsidy agreement. One of the qualifications for receiving a public subsidy agreement is that they have to raise a certain amount, $1,500 for House, $3,000 for Senate, higher amounts for constitutional office, and they have to raise it within a very specific period of time. So if some individual, again, contributes online prior to that deadline, should the committee be able to accept that contribution and, or I should say, count that contribution against the 1,500 or 3,000, whatever the threshold is, even though they don't have access to that contribution for a few days, which may take them past the deadline? What we have here is language that basically allows them to do both. One is that the C, monetary contribution made through electronic means, is received for all purposes other than the deposit requirement in Section 10A15 on the date that the contribution makes the, that the contributor makes the contribution to the contribution processor. So that's the idea that, again, if you receive a contribution prior to the deadline for the FD of the contributions, you can count that contribution towards that, that threshold amount that you must raise. D says a monetary contribution made through electronic means is received for purposes of the deposit requirements of 10A15 sub 3 on the date that the treasurer or the candidate or the committee or fund worker has access to the funds under the terms of the agreement to the with the contribution processor. So again, D, that's the trigger for the 10-day deadline in which you have to move that into your bank account. So we're trying to accommodate both things. We're trying to comply with the 10-day deposit requirement, but we're also trying to give candidates the most flexibility possible, you know, so that they can meet the threshold necessary to qualify for a public subsidy payment. On securities, the second possible rule that we believe may be technical and would be non-controversial is the securities that are provided or listed on an economic interest statement by a public official. Those are listed in subpart one. Included in that list is mutual funds, which, if you think about it, any mutual fund in which a public official has a value of over $2,500 has to be listed on the economic interest statement. The purpose of the economic interest statement is so that the public can understand if there's any possibility between an action that the public official makes and their personal interests, personal financial interests. So if they make, for example, if they take a vote on an action, an official action that might influence the outcome or the future of a particular corporation, then it would be appropriate to know if that individual held a large block of stock in that corporation. Mutual funds are rather different, at least to the extent that I understand mutual funds. You never really know exactly in any particular point in time how many shares of a particular corporation a mutual fund may hold. And what's more, the reality is that most mutual funds are so massive that the holdings of any public official are going to be not particularly affected. The value of their investment in the mutual fund is unlikely to be affected by any action that they could possibly take as a public official. The reporting obligation here for the public official, especially if their investments are in mutual funds, then would be reduced dramatically because they would no longer have to list those on the economic interest statement. And the question is whether reducing that burden on the public official would in turn have no effect on the disclosure being provided to the public as a practical matter, or conversely, if it would in fact impact the amount of disclosure that's being provided to the public that's useful for the public to assure that there isn't any conflict of interest occurring. Those are the two issues that, again, has at least initially been identified as areas that may be non-controversial enough that we will move them into the fast track, but we would like comment on that. If we've misinterpreted those two provisions, we can certainly leave them into the controversial area and deal with it in that way. If there's no particular opposition to those two areas, we may again move that into the more fast-tracked, non-controversial set of administrative rules.
I think that Mr. Ani had a
yes, sir.
Comment.
But just two items on the public subsidy that's okay. Initially given to the candidate, and then after the general election, there's another public subsidy check. That little postcard goes to the candidate at this point, and it usually takes a while for it to come back to the treasurer. And I'm just wondering why that postcard isn't just sent out directly to the treasurer, because whatever I put into the account, I mean, I tell the candidate right there. I mean, there's a lag time in between there. I just wonder if that could be changed.
It could be changed, sir, but not through this process. The requirement to send it to the candidate is actually specified in statute. So an administrative rule can, you know, provide definition, can provide additional understanding as to how a statute should be interpreted, but in this case, there's not much interpretation. The statute says that the public subsidy check is sent to the candidate at the address that the candidate provided for their residence.
Okay, that answers that one.
Yep.
And then the second one is item C here. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but I guess I got it. A monetary contribution made through electronic means is received for all purposes other than the deposit requirements in section 10A.15. Okay. A monetary contribution to me means that there's going to be a deposit. So I don't see why it says that it's other than the deposit requirements.
And perhaps we can work on the wording there. Again, what we're trying to get at is the idea that a contributor will go to, for example, a candidate's website and say, I want to contribute $75. They hit $75, at least in the majority of cases, that $75 doesn't go directly into the candidate's account. It's going to be held by PayPal or some other vendor who processes those. And typically, at least we've been told, that can be up to a 4 or 5 day process while they ensure that the funds were in fact available before they allow the treasurer or the committee to move those down into the checking account of the committee. So what we're trying to do there is acknowledge that the clock doesn't really start running for the 10-day period in which you have to deposit a contribution until you actually have access to the contribution. Otherwise, again, you may lose half of the 10-day period before you could even move the money, even if you wanted to.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. I'd like to just back up for a second here on a couple of things. One is, as I mentioned earlier, I've only been on the board for a short period of time, but one thing you come to appreciate very quickly here is that the state enjoys a tremendous technical expertise in this area with the staff of the board. And I think that it is very helpful when people like you come here and raise these questions of what's going on in the field for the staff, because they will not only be able to answer it, but they'll be able to adjust systems and the way things are handled to be more accommodating. And I have found them to be extremely embracing to me in terms of my own education on these issues. So I encourage you to continue to speak up when you're facing a problem like the cards coming to the candidate or whatever. We also have an obligation as an entity to bring matters to the legislature if, in fact, we're seeing problems that are emerging that require legislative action. So it's very appropriate for you to have raised that. On the issue of part of the reason why I think Mr. Beck's comments are important, from my standpoint, is I would encourage people in this room to just take a look at what was released yesterday publicly in terms of an investigation that occurred by the board involving purported independent expenditures. It was a complaint that had been received by the board that needed investigation that resulted in 3 depositions being taken. I won't go into the details of the findings, but they're now publicly available to you. They were posted yesterday. This is the problem that we're facing as a board. Our resources are going to be used more and more in defining issues of what is an independent expenditure as those expenditures continue to rise. And they have been rising ever since Citizens United, which is expected. So what you're hearing from Mr. Beck, a former board member, and I think the reason why there's some interest in this, is that providing clarity may reduce the number of complaints we receive. Finally, just on a very technical point, following up on Jeff's comments on the mutual fund issue, I would note that as the former director of securities for the state, mutual funds aren't regulated by the state. They are regulated federally. So the idea of requiring disclosure of them the intent of the disclosure being to show if there's any conflicts, doesn't make any sense for legislative candidates or city officials who cannot regulate them anyway because they're regulated by the SEC. So there are areas, as society evolves, we have to evolve with it, and that is an area that may have to go back to the legislature in the future, I'm not sure. But again, I would encourage you to share your comments on any topic with the staff at any time.
Ms. Pope, I forget, what was the date that we looked at for the next meeting, just to...
It's February 28th at 9 a.m., and I believe that's a Tuesday. And I don't have a room yet, but the date and the time will be posted on the website, and as soon as I have a room, then the room number will go up there as well.
Are your meetings always on Tuesdays, typically? Is that how you're structured?
No, our board meetings typically are on Wednesday mornings. Okay. And this Tuesday just happened to be the date that worked with everyone's schedule for the, okay, the next meeting. Just like today, Wednesday was the day that worked with the member's schedule, okay, for the first meeting. So they could move around.
I would emphasize that, you know, information that we have on the next meeting in terms of the agenda that we develop will be on the board's website. There is, when you go to the website, a docket link, or I guess a section of the website dedicated to the rulemaking docket. Obviously, agendas will be placed there. If we receive additional comments, they will be added there as well. We'll continue to maintain that, so that, so if you can't make a meeting, you can at least see the information that we're going to be distributing at the next meeting.
And if you haven't already, we do have a rulemaking notice email list. There's sheets at the end or up here if you haven't signed up for that already. So if you got an email that told you that this meeting was going to happen, then you're on the list. But if you didn't get that email, then if you will give us your name and your email, I'll make sure you get on the list, and then you'll get a direct email, probably about a week ahead of time, you know, telling you the location of the meeting, and then, you know, again telling you that it's on the 28th and giving you a link to the agenda and the materials.
And emphasizing the materials, that would include the first draft that the staff is going to be developing on the rules. And when you walk into the meeting on the 28th, it won't be cold where you're trying to read desperately what has been drafted so far. It's going to be, at least you'll have that week ahead of time to look at the information and determine whether or not you have concerns, and, you know, focus on those concerns for that meeting. I would also say at the next meeting, we're going to be focused on the independent expenditures. There are other topics, obviously the non-campaign disbursements and some other issues that we've raised as being in the more controversial area. But simply to break it up into more manageable blocks, staff will be focusing on the independent expenditures for the February 28th meeting. Overall, I don't think that we have a strong feeling as to how long this process will take, but I do think realistically it'll take at least four meetings to go through the various iterations of the language that staff is drafting. We'll get comments, we'll modify the language, we'll bring it back, and you know, again, trying to reach a point where the language is clear and meets the needs of both the board and the regulated community, of course, is the goal. So that's kind of the process that we're going to be taking. Everything will be on our website. Everything will be available for comment prior to the meeting. Yes, sir.
Is the board's website easier to use now?
Which one? Basically, right at the moment, we're maintaining two websites. The legacy site, to use that term, is the cfb.board.state.mn. The new website has also been released, but it's on soft release because, frankly, there are some dead ends. You'll click on a link and it'll say still under development. But it's also out there as well, we believe so. The menu process, it uses something called mega menus, so that when you click on something, basically all of your options are displayed before you at once instead of having to drill down through multiple. layers to try to find the document. The other advantage is that this is scalable. The new website works on your cell phone. It scales down to whatever device you're using. The old website, frankly, doesn't. You have to do a lot of scrolling over if you try to open it up on your cell phone. So we do think it's going to be easier once we have the a little bit more polished on the corners.
I think it'll look pretty nifty.
That's always a good thing, too. Well, with that, we're going to be, I'll ask the board members to hang around. I do know that just from conducting training, on occasion, somebody feels more comfortable to come up and ask a question, perhaps not with microphones. So we'll just kind of hang around for a few minutes, but thank you for coming, and perhaps we'll see you on the 28th.